This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading. Hello, and welcome to the well-lit back corner of the Reading Envy Pub.
Well, hello, Scott.
Hello, Jenny.
Nice to see you back.
Yes, and you as well. You as well.
Thank you. You've brought someone with you today.
I have brought someone with me. I brought my very own son. Christopher is here with us today. He's a psychology student at a university, at a major university. How should I describe it? If I say where you're from, people might stalk you.
You know, I doubt it.
Okay. He is going to Utah State University, pursuing a psychology degree at the moment.
I am.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent. Well, we're glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah.
So, do college students have time to read outside of what they have to read?
Well, that depends on whether college students decide to read what they have to read. I personally found plenty of time to read the things that I was going to discuss today.
Oh, good.
So, it's no worry.
You bet. He's looking at me like I should refrain from commenting what I'm going to say, but no, I'm not.
Oh, well, that also depends on whether or not I pay attention to my parents' comments, which doesn't exactly happen all the time.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. I just don't remember having time to read in college. I was practicing.
Really? I remember, you know, I didn't read a heck of a lot in college, but I remember some of the things I read were, you know, stuck with me for a long time.
My professors seem to believe that assignments are what you don't do now. So now all I do is read. And that's all I have to do. And my professors are just like, come to class and let's discuss. And that's how I get my grade. So usually I pick a paragraph and just talk about that one.
Oh, no. I hated those people.
you're letting all your secrets out.
Oh, whoops.
So when
I went to grad school, you know, with a guy who would do that all the time.
Oh, well, I also don't speak very often, so it doesn't look too conspicuous. So
I discovered really late in my college career, and maybe this is useful for somebody, but when you're behind on your reading, you can zip through it by reading the first and last sentence of every paragraph.
Mm.
Is that
definitely
horrible?
True in a textbook.
Yeah. But I actually, you know, I was in engineering school, so I was doing math problems mostly. Not a lot of reading by the end of my college, so maybe that's why reading was okay for me, because I didn't really have a lot of it, especially that last 2 years.
I
was doing projects and programming computers and doing math.
I was reading music.
You were reading music.
That sounds like a good program. I should have just done that.
That's right. if he changes his major by the end of this podcast, I'm going to be furious.
It'll be my fault.
There you go.
Excellent. Well, I brought some books, and we all did.
Oh, good.
Cool.
Absolutely. Well, so you want to start?
Yeah, I get to go first.
All right.
I have brought with me a book that I just finished rereading. And I love it so much that I need to talk about it. It's called Hyperion by Dan Simmons. Have you read this one, Jenny?
I have not.
You have not? Okay. And Chris hasn't either.
I want to someday.
I asked him earlier, and he never has.
So do you mean to say that you actually read a book from your reading goals this year already?
Yes, I did. I forgot about that. I did. Yeah,
that's amazing.
We talked about it on this podcast, and here I am. Just meeting
reporting
goals.
For duty.
Just meeting goals like crazy.
That's amazing.
You bet. So, of course, part of this goal is to read the part two. The unfortunate thing about this book is that it ends really abruptly. Just boom, done. So you've got to read book two, which I never have read. So it's called The Fall of Hyperion. Now, let's see. Hyperion in mythology is what, Chris, a titan? Chris actually does a lot of Greek mythology.
In mythology, Hyperion is the Titan Lord of the East. He's one of the 12 children of Gaia, the Earth, and Uranus, the Sky. He was involved in a war between the Titans and the gods. There's not a lot of information on Titans, just because they were kind of pretty obscure gods that the Greeks just kind of didn't really think about a lot.
Yeah. So in this book, Hyperion is the name of a planet. So that's really interesting to think about. I wish I'd known that, you know, as I was reading it, but just to see if there was some added meaning there. But Hyperion is also a poem by John Keats, which I have never read. But it's on Wikipedia, it says that Keats wrote this poem in 1818 or so, and it was based on the Titanomachia, which is the story of the Titans that Chris just described. So that's pretty cool. It says Hyperion is an abandoned epic poem. So somebody must have picked it up, because people, never mind. So anyway, what's cool about Hyperion, I mean, there are many cool things, but it ends up being kind of like a short story collection, because it's written a whole lot like the Canterbury Tales, which the last time I finished this book, I thought, you know, I need to read the Canterbury Tales, and this time I think I need to read it again. So I never did read the Canterbury Tales. I've read a few of the tales in it, but never the whole book. But what's happening in the book is there is a sort of religion that has grown up around this mysterious creature called the Shrike, S-H-R-I-K-E, that is on this planet Hyperion. And seven people have come together for a pilgrimage to the Shrike on Hyperion. And what happened, I have a little section to read that kind of sets up the story. So I'm going to read that real fast if I could. And it kind of captures the tone, some of the tone of the book. So there's seven people here on a spaceship. So it is a futuristic science fiction novel. Weintraub unconsciously rocked the child sleeping against his chest. For instance, does anyone here know why he or she was chosen by the Shrike Church and the All Thing to go on this voyage? No one spoke. I thought not, said Weintraub. Even more fascinating, is anyone here a member or follower of the Church of the Shrike? I, for one, am a Jew, and however confused my religious notions have become these days, they do not include the worship of an organic killing machine. Weintraub raised heavy eyebrows and looked around the table. I am the true voice of the tree, said Hat Mastine. While many Templars believe that the Shrike is the avatar of punishment for those who do not feed from the root, I must consider this a heresy not founded in the covenant or the writings of Muir. To the captain's left, the consul shrugged. I am an atheist, he said, holding the glass of whiskey to the light. I have never been in contact with the Shrike cult. Father Hoyt smiled without humor. The Catholic Church ordained me, he said. Shrike worship contradicts everything the Church defends. Colonel Cassad shook his head. Whether in refusal to respond or to indicate that he was not a member of the Shrike Church, it was not clear. Martin Salinas made an expansive gesture. I was baptized a Lutheran, a subset which no longer exists. I helped create Zen Gnosticism before any of your parents were born. I've been a Catholic, a revelationist, a neo-Marxist, an interface zealot, a bound shaker, a Satanist, a bishop in the Church of the Jakes Nada, and a dues-paying subscriber to the Assured Reincarnation Institute. Now I am happy to say I am a simple pagan. He smiled at everyone. To a pagan, he concluded, the Shrike is a most acceptable deity. I ignore religion, said Bron Lamia. I do not succumb to them. My point has been made, I believe, said Saul Weintraub. None of us admits to subscribing to the Shrike cult dogma, yet the elders of that perceptive group have chosen us, etc., etc. So I was going to stop there. But so these seven people just start these conversations, and none of them know each other. They came together on this ship to do this pilgrimage. And none of them, you know, they all feel as if they were selected, and they're assuming that all the other ones have been selected too. And then what happens is that one of them suggests that, hey, maybe we should tell each other our stories, and maybe through our stories we will understand something about what we are going to see. Because they don't all, you know, nobody understands what the Shrike is, really. And then they proceed to tell the most amazing stories. They're absolutely incredible. There's three of them that are just simply jaw-dropping, you know, five-star. This is just a wonderful book. One of them, let's see, I don't want to give away too much, but it starts with the priest's tale, which is, you know, I don't know what else to say other than amazing, because I don't want to give anything away. But it's a case of this priest saying, okay, in order to tell you my story, I need to tell this guy's story. And then he starts to tell the story of this guy named Father Paul Duret, who went to Hyperion after being almost exiled by the Catholic Church because of a discovery that he had made, and he had interpreted the data in a certain way to make it, in his mind, he thought it was proof that the Christian Church existed on other planets. And he wanted that to be true so bad that his archaeological data, he ended up skewing it, whether on purpose or subconsciously. And so he ended up getting kind of shoved out. So he goes to Hyperion on this assignment. You know, so the church said, well, you know, you can go to Hyperion. In fact, I think, if I remember right, he requested it. So he goes there, and he ends up in a spot where he's living with a tribe, I guess you'd call it, of people that all seem as if they're kind of stunted mentally. And they live in a really mysterious way. And then eventually he realizes that they're not letting him leave. He tries to leave, and they always, you know, say you can't leave anymore. And gosh, and then just what happens is just stunning. I'm certainly not going to reveal that. Then there's the soldier's tale, the poet's tale. The poet's tale is cool. There, one other thing that happens in there is the poet gets so rich at one point in the story that he has a house that has what's called a Farcaster portal on every door. So it's like his living room is on one planet, and then you go from the living room to this central area, and then you go through another door, and that's where his bedroom is, and it's on another planet just by stepping through this door. And his bathroom was on an ocean. It was just like a shack floating on an ocean, and he did his business through a hole into the ocean on some other planet. So that's what you do when you have billions and billions of dollars, as a poet, no less.
So is the sequel written in the same style with a set of stories?
I don't see how it could be, because, you know, and again, I haven't read it, but I don't see how it could be, because they've told their tales. And then at the very end of the book, they've reached their destination. Hmm. And it's almost, well, practically literally, you know, I'm not giving anything away. Well, nah, it's not a climax in any way, shape, or form. But at the very end of the book, they are walking towards where the Shrike, where they expect the Shrike to be. It's almost like, you know, we're off to see the wizard, which, yeah, I won't spoil it any more than that. But that's where it ends. It's like, you know, you read this whole book about them wanting to go on this, or going on this pilgrimage to the Shrike, each telling a stunning story that has something to do with the Shrike in it. And then it ends without you ever getting to see the Shrike. So it's like the fall of Hyperion is the second half of this one book. That's really the way it is.
And so it does make you wonder what happens next.
Yeah, it really does. But I don't expect it to be the same kind of book. Hmm. And it's funny, because the fall of Hyperion is, it seems to be one of those books that people love and hate. I've had as many people tell me, oh, I can't wait till you read The Fall of Hyperion, and as have said, you're not going to like that. I wouldn't even bother. You know, I've heard that several times too. So it's funny.
Yeah.
Now, Dan Simmons, you know, I've liked everything that I've read of his so far. I haven't read a ton, but he does this double, you know, not a trilogy, but a two-book pair. Like he wrote the Hyperion Cantos is like two groups of two. So you have Hyperion and The Fall of Hyperion, and then you have Endymion. I don't know if that is that another Greek god. Chris shakes his head no. And then the one after that is called The Rise of Endymion. So I'm assuming that that's going to also just stop. And then I read a book called The Ilium. And there's a book after it called Olympos. And I never read Olympos, so here's my pattern, right? Ilium was terrific. It's a science fiction retelling of the Iliad. Well, it's not so much a retelling as an inspiration by. It's like there's these aliens. I just dimly remember it. There's these aliens that are somehow living the Iliad, if I remember right. And but not, you know, not in a literal sense. So I don't know what else to say about this book other than, you know, I would definitely highly recommend it. Even to someone who doesn't like science fiction, this would be kind of a neat, an introduction. It was written in 1990. So it is older, but it reads like a newer piece of science fiction, a new really good piece of science fiction.
I feel like I know a lot of people who, if you ask them what their favorite book is, this is what they say.
Really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I believe it.
Even a student that works for me. Yeah.
Yeah. It's stunning. There's the Scholar's Tale. It just rips my heart out to read that story. Yeah. So highly recommended.
Do you know The Orphan's Tales? It's a set of two books by Catherine Valente.
No.
It's some of her earlier work, but it's kind of like one of those things where there's a framework and this young girl, she might be a princess. She's an orphan, I think. Mm-hmm. And she's telling a story within a story within a story.
Hmm.
It's more Arabian Nights than it is Canterbury Tales, but it does make me think of that.
So when you say Arabian Nights, is Arabian Nights have a connecting story or is it just a collection of stories? That are loosely related by setting, I guess, right?
Don't know.
Okay.
Actually, don't know the answer to that.
All right. I thought it was like a collection of stories that are kind of, you know, grouped by setting, I think. You know, it's like they all happen in Arabia or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is like some of those stories I've meant to go back and reread because her writing is so beautiful.
Oh, that's cool. Catherine Valente. Nice. She's one of your favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, of course, I thought of her.
Nice. Yeah. So, what do you think, Chris? Is that interesting at all?
Yeah, I like the idea of telling a bunch of stories kind of in one common theme. When you say that each of these stories are just amazing and you like them, I just kind of wonder, like, why is it that you say that you like them so much? Is it when I read a book, I love it when there's like moral aspects to it or moral lessons for you to learn from it, or sometimes they're just thrilling. Would you say that why would you say that you liked these stories so much? Not necessarily like because of what's in them, but like, did you learn things from them?
Well, the reason that I like these stories so much is, you know, when I'm so affected by a story, it's really emotional content. I have a serious, big emotional reaction to The Scholar's Tale. And I really can't tell you why. It's just, you know, without giving too much away. But when I read that story, I'm emotionally affected. And in addition to that, the science fiction ideas in each story, there are things going on. Like that room, that house that I was talking to you about. It's like, I love ideas like that. That's, they're exciting. So that story in particular, to me, it was that idea.
Okay.
And then the scholar's tale, it was completely emotional. And the priest's tale, which I told you a little bit about, again, was a, it was a deeply affecting, on a religious level, story. So it was emotional and religious and not so much science fictional, although it had an epic quality to it. You know, when you start to think about, well, you know, that's one of the things that I love about science fiction, that science fiction can do that general fiction can't, is thinking about, you know, well, what about Christianity? Could Christianity be on another planet? And in, as soon as you do that, you know, as a Christian, I look at that and it shifts my viewpoint almost to a, I'm not saying like a higher plane, I'm saying like from a farther back view. So you're standing back and you're looking at that, and, you know, I happen to believe that my worldview needs to be able to withstand that. You know, I need to be able to look at that and say, when we are on 12,000 planets or whatever, assuming that that's the fate of humanity, will Christianity still make any sense at all? Will it have any sort of application? You know, does it fall apart when you get into space?
These or will things... it be Shrikeanity?
Exactly, exactly.
Is that what the god was called?
Yeah, the Shrike. Yeah, the Shrike Church, right. So, but yeah, but that's an excellent question. So, you know, stories affect me for different reasons. But this one, if I had to say why I like the book as a whole, it's emotional content.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Emotional content enhanced by deep science fiction themes. and, you know, religious stuff, too. I love when the science fiction starts to touch religion. I like it. Mm. Yeah. But excellent question. So what have you got for us?
So the first book that I want to talk about today is a book by Richard Preston. It was written in 1998. It was published in 1998. It's called The Cobra Event. Have you ever heard of it, Jenny?
No.
Okay, cool.
I was writing it down.
The Cobra Event.
This book is definitely like top five. One of the best books I've ever read. My first exposure to it was actually in high school. My high school English teacher felt like this was a book that we needed to read, that it would just kind of expose us to extraordinary literary abilities and kind of things that really make you think about the world. It's a crime novel written about an attempt on a bioterrorism event on New York City. So it shifts back and forth. It gives you some background into biological engineering history, and it kind of talks about some things that are most likely not factual, but are written and researched in such a way that could have been factual, or events similar to that could have happened.
This is a novel, right?
Yes, this is a novel. It's not... it's not an actual event that happened. I don't think that the government would like that published. But it's so well-researched, and almost all of the science in there is factual. And the government response to the event in the book is based on research that the author went to people and is like, so if this happened, how would you respond? And he put those responses in the book. At the end, there's this little narrative that he puts in there that he talks about. He actually fudged or like blurred some of the science in there so that he wouldn't be publishing a recipe for bioterrorism, which I thought was kind of funny. The book starts out with this case of a girl in high school who wakes up with a cold, and she goes to class and is just kind of feeling worse and worse and worse as the day progresses. And it eventually culminates into she starts having a seizure, and she starts bleeding, and bleeding from like the mouth and the nose. And she actually starts to self-cannibalize, which was absolutely just terrifying to read. Like, my heart was racing. I could feel the adrenaline. Yeah, and this book, like, I don't usually get pumped up by books. Mm-hmm. But this book is scary. Like, it's one of those books that you don't want to read while you're eating or, like, you know, at night. It's, you want to read it in a well-lit place with lots of people where everything is just going fine. Anyway, and so the main character, Alice Austin, is an epidemiologist from the CDC, and she's kind of doing this internship stage, and so she's sent on this basically a wild goose chase kind of thing, or that's what she thinks it's going to be, to New York City, where she ends up in the OCME, the medical examiner's office, and she kind of ends up doing this, I guess it's best described kind of like a Sherlock Holmes kind of thing. She just kind of runs around, does this investigation, trying to figure out where the connections between the different cases are, and eventually kind of comes up with this idea of this virus, and she basically figures out that it's not natural, it's an engineered weapon, and that's when the FBI and everything comes in. One of my favorite parts of the book is that the author splits the story up, and so he tells part of it from the perpetrator's perspective. So he actually refers to himself as Archimedes because of Archimedes from Syracuse. He thinks of himself as a great inventor, a great thinker, and he honestly thinks of himself as a great humanitarian. He talks about he has this just extremely interesting perspective that I feel like you find a lot with extremists. And he talks about how the human race is kind of more of just a species blown out of proportion, gone out of control. And he has just this absolute fascination with viruses. And he talks about how viruses are nature's way of thinning populations, of keeping populations in control. And so when I think about viruses, I think they're, you know, they're all bad. They're terrible things that happen to people. But it's kind of the way that the author writes his perspective really makes you sit down and think, like, you know, there are alternative perspectives, and there's different ways to look at things that are perfectly valid, although, you know, don't necessarily agree with my personal values. And I thought that was something that's very interesting to read about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some of my favorite parts in the book were, like, I'm a psychology student, and there's so much neuroscience in here, and so a lot of my favorite parts of the book were the really technical aspects of the book. And so there's lots of discussion on neural anatomy and how the nervous system works and that kind of thing. And so I think if you're somebody who's really into the nervous system, psychology, anatomy, this is a great book for you to read, especially if you want to, like, read it and have fun. Mm-hmm. If you're not into that stuff, those parts of the book may be hard to get through, but
that's funny. You've watched a lot of Bones mm-hmm. growing up, Temperance Brennan. Mm-hmm. So as you describe it, it reminds me of her. Does the character remind you of her at all? Is it the same kind of technical stuff?
So with Bones, Temperance Brennan is super science. Like, she's all about, rationality and evidence and the really empirical kind of aspects of science. Alice Austin is not a lot like Temperance Brennan. She's a person who she feels really deeply. I mean, and not to say that Temperance Brennan doesn't, but you get tons of emotion with Alice Austin in the book, and those are also some of the best parts. She has several instances where she kind of feels the world through the perspective of the victim at the very beginning of the book. And some of the things that she just, it's amazing the connection that she creates with the victim, because it really helps you understand how empathy works and how, when you're, I feel like if I were in that position, if I were working that case, the empathy really gives you this drive to solve what's going on, instead of being like, oh, that sucks, that's horrible, you know? It kind of gives you this drive to be like, you know, this is a problem, we need to fix it.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was poking around, and it looks like he also writes nonfiction.
He does, yeah.
And he wrote a book about Ebola in 1993.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Hot Zone, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's why I asked the question of whether it was a novel or not, because when I can see the cover in my head, you know, and I'm like, isn't that a non? I always thought it was nonfiction. So this one is a novel. Yeah,
yeah, it is a novel. But if you knew nothing about it, you would really think that it could have happened. It's mm-hmm. one of those books that, and that's why I think that it's so frightening. And so thrilling to read is because you're reading this and you're going, this is all stuff that could happen. Like, yeah. You know, if strange things start happening, I'm gonna be wearing a mask around.
Did it turn kind of into a zombie book? You were talking about cannibalism and things.
No. Well, so the virus mm-hmm. attacks the central nervous system. It basically, like, it latches onto your membranes. So, like, in your mouth, mm-hmm. your nose, and your eyes. And it shoots straight from the nerves to your brain and basically just implodes it. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff that happens is the virus kind of it destroys the forebrain and really affects the midbrain and the hindbrain, the more primal parts of your behavior. So that's where things that's where you get, like, there's one case where this guy gets super aggressive and he actually kills another of the medical examiners. And there's all this stuff that's going on because you don't have your reasoning anymore. And there's, I mean, not to give too much away, but the virus is, it's genetically engineered, so it's a chimera. They refer to it in the book as, and so it's got all these different things. And so some of the diseases that are included in the virus cause people to self-cannibalize and that kind of thing, but I wouldn't describe it as zombie-ish at all.
Okay. The other thing that I thought of as you were describing it was Jurassic Park, the novel. I know you really liked that.
Mm-hmm.
Did that kind of hit you in the same way, you know, the way he got into technical stuff? Do you feel like it's the same kind of novel?
Yeah, I mean, and it's been a long time since I read Jurassic Park, but the Jurassic Park seems much farther off than this.
Mm.
This is all stuff that, like, it's, I don't know if I'd describe it as science fiction, not really, because this is all technology that we have now. Like, it's, I mean, and this is, you know, 13 years ago or yeah, more.
Sure.
And so this is all stuff that has been going on and is present. And so Jurassic Park is all stuff that you're like, yeah, that could happen. But Cobra Event is more like, we have this stuff and it might happen. And wow. So that's why it's, I mean, Jurassic Park is thrilling and the ideas are really fascinating, but this is stuff that just chills you to the bone, really.
Yeah.
It kind of makes me think of how I felt when I read The Stand by yeah. Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
I had a really, really awful cold.
Yeah.
And that's the book I chose to read, which is, of course, completely the wrong book if you know anything about that novel.
Yeah.
It's probably the same with this one. Like, if everything starts with a headache and...
Yeah,
right. You probably wouldn't.
And I... Funny, I had a cold, too, while I was reading it. I was pretty much bedridden for a week, so I was like, well, I'll finish this book and... Yeah, I was just like, I'm just glad my cold's not getting worse. Otherwise, I'd be pretty worried.
Wow.
It's funny how that can happen.
That is
cool.
Nice. Nice, nice.
Well, that's all I have, really. Okay. How about you, Jenny?
Well, speaking of cannibals.
Okay.
I have had a really interesting month of reading. I've talked about one book from Papua New Guinea already, and I have read... Let's see, a book about, it's called Savage Harvest, about the Michael Rockefeller disappearance in New Guinea.
I remember you
and
saying
that
something
led
about
me
that.
On a path of reading a whole bunch of other books about that time period. And then I realized that I had another book set in Papua New Guinea, and it's actually a novel. It's called Euphoria by Lily King.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just came out last year. Yeah, it's a 2014. She's probably best known for the novel The News from Paraguay. Is that the same person? I might be thinking of the wrong Lily. Anyway, it's about an anthropologist in Papua New Guinea in the 1930s. It's based on the life of Margaret Mead. And there's kind of a trio of anthropologists. It's her and it's her husband and then this other man who's been working on the Sepik River. And they have to leave a tribe. The couple has to leave a tribe that you don't really know why at the beginning, but the research hasn't gone well. So they're looking for another group of people to study. And of course, along that river, that's where the language changes every 90 miles. So there's a lot to choose from. And I didn't know at first that it was based on the life of Margaret Mead. So that's really interesting because I have several books now that I've been getting in the mail and from the library that are written by Margaret Mead. Of her research in New Guinea and Samoa and some of those other places. So I feel like I'm going to keep going backwards in time almost, reading some of these things.
Like a Michener novel.
Yeah.
Except
only at the opposite.
At the beginning, yeah. The Earth Was Cooling is chapter one.
Yeah, and so in this novel, most of it is told... I mean, it goes backwards and forwards in time, kind of. So some of it's told in the present tense, but... you know, the characters have moved on from that point in time. Some of it's told in the journals of the various characters. So what I was going to read is from the female character, mm-hmm. her journal. Let's see. Her name is Nell. February 1st. I understood my first joke today. I was observing the weaving of mosquito bags in the second women's house. I sat next to a woman called Toddy, and I asked her what she would do with the shells she earned, and she said her husband would use them to buy another wife. I cannot make this bag fast enough, she said. We all fell over laughing. My mind has circled back again to that conversation with Helen on the steps of Schmermerhorn, sorry, about how each culture has a flavor. What she said that night comes back to me at least once a day. Have I ever said anything to anyone that has come back once a day for 8 years? She had just returned from the Zunis, and I had never been anywhere, and she was trying to tell me that nothing we're taught will help us to identify or qualify that unique flavor that we need most to absorb and capture on the page. She seemed so old to me then. 36 she would have been, and I thought it would take me 20 years to learn what she meant. But I knew it as soon as I got to the Solomon Islands. And now I'm engulfed in this new flavor, so different from the light but humorless flavor of the Anapa and the thick, bitter taste of the Mumbanyo, this rich, deep, resonant, complex flavor that I'm only getting my first sips of. And yet, how do I explain these differences to an average American who will take one look at the photographs and see black men and women with bones through their noses and lump them in a pile marked savages? So,
wow.
Yeah, and the story itself is really compelling. Of course, it's always really difficult when you're going into a culture that's so different from yours and trying to understand it from their perspective. And that's what anthropology is all about. And it also focuses a lot on just the struggles that anthropologists go through, you know, their own identity, why they're doing what they're doing, their relationships with each other, how the research changes them. Anyway. That's
how the research
book.
Changes the subjects, you mean?
No, changes the people doing the research.
Oh, huh?
I mean, I think it's natural that, any outside influence is going to have an impact on the culture you're studying, but more often it probably has an impact on you.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that, you know, with anthropology, the goal is not to overwhelm them with your culture. The goal is to be as just kind of as unrippling as possible. And so... you know, when you have one person inserted into another culture, the effects of that culture are going to be way greater than the effects of that one person's culture on, you know, the other culture.
Absolutely. Like, you spend all your time trying to become an insider, but can you, in a culture that doesn't have a concept of time, has no written language, and thinks that eating people from a warring tribe is what you do?
Wow.
You know, so it's a big challenge. That's probably maybe one of the hardest cultures to really crack into. And of course, in Papua New Guinea, there are many different tribes and cultures within that. So some of the like Papua New Guinea culture concepts that she uses are true to life, and some of them are a little bit of a stretch. But you know, it's a novel, so
yeah.
I let her have that room.
Well, cool.
But Papua, that's like,
New Guinea, yeah.
Yeah, it's the only novel I've read. I've been reading a lot of nonfiction, but my other...
Really? That's not typical for you.
I know. So I felt like, wow, I should kind of mix it up a little bit. But
well, that's cool.
Yeah, I've decided there's so much more to read about Papua New Guinea and West Papua, used to be called Irian Java, that I'm going to spend another month there.
Wow.
With cannibals and the coffee and the sweet potatoes.
Cannibals, coffee, and sweet potatoes. Oh, my.
Yeah.
Well,
it's fascinating.
That's neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting learning about this through you. Yeah.
I might go to the jungle and never leave.
Yep. Well, cool.
So how about you, Scott? You have another book?
My next book. Which, it's funny how themes kind of come up, isn't it?
Because this is another cannibal book.
No, this is.
Oh. That would be funny. Standing.
That is funny. I'm thinking, you know, religion and science.
Oh,
and yeah.
You know, that's fun too.
That's fun too. I read this really, really neat book called "Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial?" By Guy Consolmagno and Father Paul Muller. They're both Jesuits, and Pope Francis is a Jesuit. So they're all of the same religious order. Now, this book, one of the things, you know, as a Catholic person that bothers me a whole lot is getting lumped in with sects of Christianity that, you know, think that science is something that needs to be fought. You know, as if, you know, they need to take a literal reading of the Bible, you know, like the most common thing is like the origin story and saying, you know, evolution can't possibly be true because it says here that, you know, the earth was created in 7 days and that needs to be taken literally. And then, you know, it all goes so far as to, people demanding that in the public schools we need to teach that, you know, the earth was created in 7 days. It's very, very, very problematic. So but anyway, what this has created is a culture in which I think it's a very, very common belief amongst people that you choose between science and religion. As if they were two different things that you get to pick from. You are either a science person or you are a religion person. You don't get to be both. And the whole concept of that is really recent. You know, it used to be that the people doing the science were religious people, all of them, because they're the ones that had the time to do that. You know, the people that discovered genetics and the Big Bang theory was discovered by
Pavlov.
You know, yeah, Pavlov is the dog. Mendel was the one who did genetics, right? And he was a monk. And then I can't remember the guy who came up with the Big Bang theory.
No idea.
But he was also a monk or a religious person. But this book, Brother Guy Consolmagno has. He's a Vatican astronomer. In fact, both these guys are. They work for the Vatican astronomy. The Vatican has telescopes in Castel Gandolfo, which is in Italy, and they also have one in Tucson. And these guys are Jesuits, and one of the things about Jesuits is that they have a career usually that they're not parish priests. So you could have... Guy Consolmagno is a brother. He's not a priest. But you can have a... You would be a priest, but you could also be like an astronomer, right? So, you know, these guys, it's not like they just have religion degrees. You know, these guys are doctors of astronomy that also are a priest. You know, so they went through all the training for a priest as well. And then, you know, the Jesuits are often the ones that found schools. Like a lot of the Catholic high schools are Jesuit schools. So anyway, so I'm not trying to proselytize or anything here, but I think that this is, I read this book with a lot of joy because it's like when you read something that you totally agree with and you're like, oh, they explained it so well, you know, you're like really happy. So I would recommend this book for anybody who wants to just understand what a typical Catholic or mostly most religious folks, I think, view science. I don't think that most of the religious people in the United States have a problem with science. You know,
but didn't they kill someone for saying that the Earth revolved around the sun?
No. As a matter of fact, that's described in here. That's Galileo. Galileo was not killed for that at all. But it actually, it's funny that you say that because that is something that they bring up all the time. They explain exactly what happened with Galileo. In fact, there's a whole chapter called What Really Happened to Galileo. And he was, the thing was, in a nutshell, there was a lot of personality conflict between Galileo and some other people. Galileo offended people. It was more of a, we're the people in power and you're offending us kind of a thing, more than any kind of a religious thing. But he was not put to death at all. He wasn't, I'm not saying that the Catholic Church is clean of putting people to death ever, but I'm saying that in that case, that's not what happened. He was, first of all, he was at the end of his life, but he was living at a bishop's house, like under kind of a house arrest for a while there at the end of his life. But he was not put to death. But the story is long, and it describes it in here. But I just wanted to read just a little bit so you kind of get the flavor. The thing is, the whole book is written in a dialogue format, kind of in a tribute to Galileo, which is how he would write. That's one of the things that he did that offended people, is there was a certain viewpoint put out by, like, the Pope, who said, aren't things like, you know, this way, you know, and he presented that. And then Galileo wrote a book, and I forget what he named. It was like Simplicio or something like that, is what he named the character that had the viewpoint that the Pope had. Or a high Vatican official. I can't remember the exact details, but so he was saying that, you're a simpleton and I'm putting it in this book, and I'm calling you Simplicio. So he was angering people that had the power.
Never a great idea.
Never a really good idea. Okay. So just to get a flavor of this book, again, it's written as a dialogue format, so it's between Guy and Paul, you know, the authors of the book. Guy says, "What is it about questions of this sort that raise such interest and sometimes suspicion and fear among so many people? Let's face it, most people know that we're not likely to be running into any ETs anytime soon. Nor is it the exact nature of the Star of Bethlehem. Nor is the exact nature of the Star of Bethlehem essential to any catechism or creed. But people care. They keep asking us why. This book is about what's behind those questions." And then Paul says, "And this book is about what it's like when science encounters faith on a friendly, mutually respectful terms. Do you think we should reject any results of modern science that seem to disagree with the Bible? Do you think that the Bible has greater authority than science, and that that biblical faith should always get the last word over science? If so, this might not be the book for you, but read on. Do you think we should reject anything in the Bible that seems to be at odds with modern science? Do you think that science has a greater authority than the Bible, and that science should always get the last word over biblical faith? If so, this might not be the book for you, but read on. Do you think that both science and faith should be taken seriously, but you struggle with how to hold science and faith together with integrity? Do you find yourself tending to keep science and faith isolated from each other in separate watertight compartments, but you wish that science and faith didn't have to take turns in your life? Then this is the book for you. Read on." That's the kind of tone. And I highlighted one other thing just to get a flavor of when they're really into the conversation about, you know, about how deep it goes. Because it's not a super deep book, but it's a genuine conversation. And they realize that other people have a different viewpoint. So again, I would recommend this book for people who want to understand what the viewpoint is. You know, if you have a question like, how can people have faith and believe in science as well at the same time? If that's an honest question in your mind, I genuinely and wholeheartedly recommend this book. But here's just a little piece when they're deep into something. Paul says, I return to the theme we started on day one of this conversation. The universe is either a chaos or a logos. Either it is meaningless and pointless, or it is meaningful and rational. We can't prove that it's one or the other. Using the notion of proof would presuppose that the universe is meaningful and rational. But we can't do science unless we assume that it's a logos. Christians choose to live in the hope that the universe is a logos. That is, that it is meaningful, valuable, and rational. That is their faith. And then Guy says, worth, value, meaning, these things can't be weighed or measured. They're not material. But if you argue that they don't exist, then by the very fact that you find the point worth arguing, you're contradicting yourself. So that's just an example of how deep the conversation gets. Doesn't get much farther than that. So it's a, and it's a really good introduction to a lot of concepts in science that are floating around today. You know, they talk about a lot of different things, you know, like the God particle, the Higgs boson stuff, all that stuff they talk about. Again, they, like you mentioned Galileo, they describe the entire events of Galileo, and what happened there. And, anyway, I found it I liked it very, very much.
So, would you baptize an extraterrestrial?
If she asks. If I'd, it's funny, the title comes from Brother Guy Consolmagno was at a conference in England. Pope Benedict was visiting England, and it was very controversial. A lot of people didn't want him to be there. So, he was asked, he had a press conference for this conference he was at, and he was being peppered with questions by a, you know, kind of a hostile bunch of journalists. And one of the journalists asked him, would you baptize an extraterrestrial? Thinking, well, that's a gotcha question, right? Whatever he answers to this question is going to be like a big headline, right? Vatican astronomer says to baptize extraterrestrials or whatever. So that's where the title came from. And his answer to that reporter was, if she asks.
Hmm.
That was what he said.
Clever.
Clever, yeah. I think, you know, he robbed that person of a headline. And it was a good answer. And it really is a genuinely good answer. You know, who knows? And again, you know, like I said earlier, it has to do with, you know, you look at it and it makes you think about, you know, is this relevant? You know, when you pull back and you look at the big picture, is it still relevant? You know, and to me, it's an important answer that it be yes, but it gets me thinking down those lines. You know, is it really? Well, I don't know. You know, let's just think about it.
So somehow, your science fiction, fantasy, outer space novel, and this book.
Yeah.
Kind of made you think about the same stuff.
That's exactly what I meant when I said that at the beginning. It's funny how things emerge, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's I wonder if it's sometimes how, you know, I read this book first, the extraterrestrial one, and then I read Hyperion, you know, so it's in there. And then I read Hyperion, and maybe that aspect of Hyperion on the second read is what jumps out at me.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
You know.
But that's why it's only one aspect a book is good, right?
Yeah, yeah. Especially a book like Hyperion, which I think you could read multiple times.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think, Chris?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't have big thoughts on religion or, and I know almost nothing about science that's not inside your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess things like that are really interesting to think about, but honestly, I don't have enough of a knowledge base to comment on it.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, so that's, you know, that's it. Again, the reason I wanted to bring it up in this podcast is not to try to convince anybody of anything other than that these thoughts are compatible thoughts. You know, it's not an exclusive choice that a person needs to make. And it's not only Christianity as well. You know, there's other religions as well. It's not as if it's, you know, Christianity is the one, though. You know, again, you know, most of the news I get in the United States is from the United States. So, you know, I have a very limited knowledge, but it certainly seems that the Christian faith seems to be at odds in this country with science. And, you know, I see people like Richard Dawkins and things like that. And I'm like, I watch them and it's always, it's just frustrating as heck to watch them and have them say, well, you know, this and this and this. And you're just like, but I don't even agree with the first part of what you said or the premise, you know, that you're arguing. You know, you're making an assumption that is true for a certain segment of people, but certainly not myself. So his arguments don't have any sway because it doesn't make any sense at the beginning, you know? I think that I struggled with the conflict a lot earlier in life, but now I'm just frustrated by it. Yeah. Anyway, onward. What do you have next, Chris?
Okay, so my next book that I chose was Divergent. It's very, very popular in YA kind of groups. I would say it's science fiction, but it's definitely not one of those deep thinker science fictions like Scott's talking about, like with Hyperion. There's not there's not portals between houses and that kind of thing, or inside houses. But I love the psychology in this book. And so, again, Scott's got his theme. My theme is psychology and neuroscience. There's a lot of discussion, or maybe not discussion, but comments on human nature in this book that I just found fascinating. And so the idea is that in this futuristic society, this is post-apocalyptic, you know, there's this huge war that's kind of ravaged the world. And so these people are living in Chicago, though they don't ever refer to it as Chicago, but they make references to Millennium Park and all that kind of thing that lets you know that you're in Chicago. And so these people are all walled into this city, and they've divided the government into five factions. They've got abnegation, candor, dauntless, erudite, and amity. And each of these factions believes that there's a certain aspect of human nature that's to blame for the wars, for the destruction that's happened. So abnegation believes that selfishness is the problem. Dauntless believes cowardice is the problem. Candor believes dishonesty. Erudite blames ignorance, and amity blames conflict and contention. So you've got these people who all have these different viewpoints, and when they're raised to believe this certain viewpoint, so there's a lot of kind of, just within this city, a lot of different cultures, and you really see the culture shock and the conflict between cultures that have different viewpoints when they're in a close proximity within this book. So that I'll just read to you the first part from chapter one. It says, "There is one mirror in my house. It is behind a sliding panel in the hallway upstairs. Our faction allows me to stand in front of it on the second day of every third month, the day my mother cuts my hair. I sit on the stool, and my mother stands behind me with the scissors, trimming. The strands fall on the floor in a dull blonde ring. When she finishes, she pulls my hair away from my face and twists it into a knot. I note how calm she looks and how focused she is. She is well practiced in the art of losing herself. I can't say the same of myself. I sneak a look at my reflection when she isn't paying attention. Not for the sake of vanity, but out of curiosity. A lot can happen to a person's appearance in 3 months. In my reflection, I see a narrow face, wide, round eyes, and a long, thin nose. I still look like a little girl, though sometime in the last few months I turned 16. The other factions celebrate birthdays, but we don't. It would be self-indulgent. There, she says, when she pins the knot in place. Her eyes catch mine in the mirror. It is too late to look away, but instead of scolding me, she smiles at our reflection. I frown a little. Why doesn't she reprimand me for staring at myself? So today's the day, she says. Yes, I reply. Are you nervous? I stare into my own eyes for a moment. Today's the day of the aptitude test that will show me which of the five factions I belong in, and tomorrow, at the choosing ceremony, I will decide on a faction. I will decide the rest of my life. I will decide to stay with my family or abandon them. No, I say, the tests don't have to change our choices. Right, she smiles. Let's go to breakfast. Thank you for cutting my hair. She kisses my cheek and slides the panel over the mirror. I think my mother could be beautiful in a different world. Her body is thin beneath the gray robe. She has high cheekbones and long eyelashes, and when she lets her hair down at night, it hangs in waves over her shoulders. But she must hide that beauty in abnegation. We walk together to the kitchen. On these mornings when my brother makes breakfast and my father's hands skims my hair as he reads the newspaper, and my mother hums as she clears the table, it is on these mornings that I feel guiltiest for wanting to leave them. So that kind of, it really does a great job of setting up the character. Her name is Triss. It does a great job of setting up kind of the conflicts that she's going to have in the book. Ultimately, she has this test and she goes to the choosing ceremony and she chooses a different faction. And so that's where you get all of the culture shock and the difficulties that you see in individual experience when they are immersed in a different culture, in a culture that is almost nothing like their own, which I thought was absolutely fascinating. And then there's, I can't give away too much because it's too good. But there's a lot of neuroscience in it. And then there's also just kind of, like I said, just kind of random comments about the different ideals that these factions have and the way that Triss's ideals herself change and kind of just adjust over time. Absolutely stunned me.
Well, I just love that. You know, what you said about, you know, things that are just said while the story is going on, just every now and then are just thrown in there. Sometimes that's why I really like an author as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's almost like they're running commentary on what's happening, not so much as what is actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense at all. But, you know, when you said that, that just rings true to me anyway.
I like how those one-liners just draw your focus away from, like, it's not necessarily the events that are happening, but they draw your focus onto things that pertain to you, things that pertain to human society and just the human experience. Mm-hmm. And they really just kind of make you think, like, wow, that's so true. Or sometimes there are things that you disagree with, but even things that you disagree with, you're like, you just love to kind of think about it. It starts debates in your mind. Those are the kind of things that I love to read.
Yeah, that's cool. Are these kids threatened in any way?
Well, yes. But to reveal most of it would be a bad idea. But
that's fine.
I mean, there's conflict that comes in the book, serious, serious conflict. Mm-hmm. And it's an intense read and really thrilling and exciting. But it kind of happens. This book is really an introductory to the event, I guess. Mm-hmm. I would say.
Okay.
Have you read the other books?
I have.
In the trilogy?
I mm-hmm. have, and I loved them. There was a lot of scrutiny on the very last book, but I absolutely loved
all of them. What do you mean a lot of scrutiny on the last
one? A lot of people didn't like it.
Oh, okay.
A lot of people didn't like the second one either. But I think that the reason that a lot of people didn't like them comes from personal preference and comes from kind of an inability to remove yourself from yourself and to see things through a different perspective or see things through a damaged person's perspective. Because some pretty bad things happen to the main character. And so in the later books, she has to deal with those.
Is that what people generally object to, is that things happen to her, or
That people object to her reactions
Traumatic things in reaction to a trauma that you're like, well, I wouldn't do that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot of things like you can say all you want that I would never do that, but I mean, unless you've got PTSD, you don't really know. Mm-hmm. And even PTSD manifests differently in every individual, and so it's some of the comments that I've seen and some of the objections that I've seen just kind of seem like they're stemming from that inability to remove yourself from your own knowledge.
That's interesting. So would you call this a dystopia?
Yes. Well, yeah. I think that there's not, like, it's all one government, but there's no unity between the five factions. They all kind of, like, certain factions don't necessarily dislike each other, but there's just nothing to connect them, because they're so separate, because they believe in different things. And and later in the series there are reasons that the author gives for the differences and that kind of thing, but yeah, it's one people, but many people at the same time.
That's interesting. Yeah, I always wondered, you know, why so many dystopias, you know, in YA? Do you have an answer for that? Do you feel like it's because one came out that everybody kind of jumped on the bandwagon, or is it really kind of something going on?
I think it's definitely a popular concept now, and I mean, and it's... I feel like with modern technology, it's so easy to communicate with people all over the world. And so borders and things kind of seem less concrete now.
Mm-hmm.
But you also really kind of get that everybody's different, and like all these cultures have different viewpoints and that kind of thing. And so I feel like you have, again, the sense of being one people, like we're all human, but many people at the same time. I mean, it's just impossible to really compare yourself and to judge morality based on your culture and judging another culture. And so that's, I think it's a really popular thing that people like to think about. And it's something that I feel like, me personally, it's something that occurs to me a lot, that, you know, there are serious issues out there that, like, I don't know if I can really judge, because I'm not them, you know?
Yeah, so, I mean, you're kind of thinking that these, like, things like Hunger Games and this are almost a reaction to kind of a judgmental government / adults or something like that? I'm just thinking about, you know, YA and that.
I think that, I really would say that it's a reaction to this feeling that, you know, we've been handed a bad hand. You know, we've got a bad hand of cards, and it's not our fault for the way things are in the world. And I think that that's something that people really like to think, that, like, you know, the world's such a terrible place right now, but that's not my fault. You know, it was given to me. You know, I don't have any control over what it is now. And part of that's true. Like, we can't affect anything that happened in the past. We can just look back and hopefully try to learn from the mistakes. But I think that in a lot of these dystopian books, you really get a lot of younger individuals who are trying to change the world. And I think that as a group, these authors maybe are trying to send a message that, you know, it's not that they're saying this world isn't bad, or that, you know, there are bad things going on, but you're not impotent. And I think that that's kind of a common theme between Hunger Games, Divergent, and other dystopian books, is that you're not impotent despite how you might feel what you've been given.
That's really cool. It's like you know, so you're viewing these books as kind of a positive influence.
I think they would be. I mean, I don't know that I could say I can mark a specific change in myself, but I feel like there's lots of things in these books to kind of boost your drive to do something about stuff. Like, there's no reason that you can't try and just kind of make things better.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I recently finished reading a dystopian novel from the 70s.
Uh-huh.
And I was poking around the internet about it and found an article that was written in the last 5 years about the novel and why there's an appeal for it. And it was saying some things about kind of along the lines of what you're saying, but also we like to see, we like to put ourselves in the scenario of what would I have to do if I had to survive?
Mm-hmm.
You know, could I be strong enough? And mm-hmm. it almost becomes a fantasy, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, how that's I could, you know, yeah, kill the zombies or whatever the situation
right?
is.
Ultimately yeah, uplifting. Sure. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's kind of like those old survivalist books that you read when you're a kid.
Yeah.
Like My Side of the Mountain or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I remember that book. It's a good mm-hmm. book.
It sticks with you for that very reason.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, great. Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. Jenny, what is up?
Have you ever had a book follow you around until you read it?
No.
Well, that's kind of happened to me with this one.
Okay.
I feel like it came up 3 times this year already. And so I was like, fine, I'll read it. I mean, I've owned it on my Kindle for a while. I just forgot that I did. It's like one of those times where you like download something because it's on sale.
Mm-hmm.
And then the person who I took the creative nonfiction class for is assigning this for her other class, immersive journalism, that I'm not taking, but I wanted to live vicariously through.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone else left a comment just randomly on my Goodreads page where I'd marked it to read. And they're like, you should really read this. It's really great. So it's like, fine, I will read Desert Solitaire, A Season in the Wilderness by Edward Abbey. Speaking of Utah.
Huh. I've read that book.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's from 1968 and it's nonfiction. And Edward Abbey goes and lives in the desert in Utah, working as a park ranger, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most of the book isn't really about being a park ranger or anything. It's not like that. He talks a lot about the landscape and how in the intro he even says, but don't try to go find it. By the time you've read this, you're basically reading a tomb. They were going to dam one of the rivers and they were going to pave roads into the parks. And he was really opposed to that idea, of course. But his description of the landscape is really something to experience. I mean, he's kind of a crotchety guy. He doesn't like all these people around, but his descriptions of nature are really beautiful. So there's kind of this dichotomy going around. And he talks about some very specific adventures he has. Like, he takes this amazing river trip where he follows the rivers down to the Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this one where he goes to something called the Maze. And I looked that up, you know, because I spent a lot of my time reading this book and then the other half of the time looking up stuff he mentions to see if it's still around and if there are pictures of it online. And the maze that he talks about is still something that's off in the middle of the desert. You still have to take an off-road vehicle and carry in your own gasoline just to be able to get back. So I guess, you know, I don't really know that part of the country very well. And mm-hmm. I guess hearing that it's still that big and that open and I don't know, yeah, that was still kind of impressive.
Too. I mean, there is still, you know, if you drive from like the north part of Utah to the south part of Utah, there is a huge part of it that's just practically empty.
A lot of nothing.
Yeah.
Well, except for to hear him describe it, mm-hmm. it's not actually nothing, yeah. you know, when you look closer.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of like that, you know, because
yeah.
most people would maybe just drive by.
Yeah, I read that book like in college, you know, which was like 127 years ago. But I remember it having a religious quality. Would you say that it does? Is that mistaken?
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that he's very reverent about what he's seeing and experiencing.
Uh-huh.
But I actually have a little part I can read cool. that may...
Yeah, please do.
I have an example of that.
Mm.
This is from the section called Down the River. Down the river we drift in a kind of waking dream, gliding beneath the great curving cliffs with their tapestries of water stains, the golden alcoves, the hanging gardens, the seeps, the springs where no man will ever drink, the royal arches in high relief and the amphitheaters shaped like seashells, a sculptured landscape mostly bare of vegetation, earth in the nude. We pass sandbars where stands of white-plumed cane and the lacy blossoms of young tamarisk wave in the breeze among driftwood logs aged to a silver finish by sun and wind and water. In the lateral canyons, we sometimes see thickets of gamble oak and occasional cottonwoods with gray elephantine trunks and bright clear green leaves, delicately suspended, trembling in the air.
Yeah, that is beautiful.
It isn't always like that, but it's often like that.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. Cool. And everyone keeps telling me, you got to read more by him. He writes novels, too. So
I wasn't aware of that.
Like, eco-terrorism.
Yeah, do other, I mean, pro-eco-terrorism?
No, like, about it.
Oh, okay.
I can't. You know, this is considered a pretty early environmental work.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, like, save the environment.
Right. Is there any book that people are particularly recommending to you?
Yeah, I always hear Monkey Wrench Gang.
Oh,
it might
okay.
Be, it might be the Monkey Wrench
You know,
Wrench
I never
Gang.
Connected that to this.
But you've
the same
heard of
person.
It.
I've heard of that book, but I didn't know it was the same person.
Yeah.
That's neat.
So I have a little tiny bit to read from the very end, and I'll avoid the swear words, That's, but it kind of gives you an example of how the tone changes. I entreat you, get out of those motorized wheelchairs, get off your foam rubber backsides, stand up straight like men, like women, like human beings, and walk, walk, walk upon our sweet and blessed land.
Wow.
That's pretty funny.
That is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I read that book at a time. I remember Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was right around the same time. And then a book called Ishmael. Gosh, did
I have
that
on my shelf, but I've never read it.
Yeah, Ishmael. I wonder if Ishmael was after. Somehow it's all connected in my head, though. It's the same, I don't know, subgenre or something like that. But yeah. Yeah, I remember I liked them all. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great
book. A lot
book.
Of things I probably wouldn't agree with now. But... But isn't that funny? It would be kind of fun to reread some of that. Yeah.
How could you not agree with...
I have no idea. I just said that, and I said that, I'm like, I wonder if that's really true. Because, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Even Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, I can't think of anything off the top of my head that I would, you know, I'm like, oh, I don't believe that anymore, because now I'm all sure. You know what I mean? Which I am, you know... Not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think that these kinds of books are really interesting. When you kind of think about the values of people who are really pro, I mean, and nobody's really not pro ecosystem, but when people are pro environment and really kind of vehement about it and have this romantic kind of ideal about it. I love just listening to the way that they describe the environment, like what you read, and the way that they just make it seem like this absolutely mystical place. And definitely, like, there are places in the world like that that you just go and you're just absolutely fascinated. They have like the feeling you get when you're in a cathedral or when you're in some kind of huge religious, just reverent place. There's something else there. And you can't quite put your finger on it. But I think it's also interesting when you get to people who are so pro-environment that they're almost anti-people. And they're like, you know, you need to stop everything that you're doing. Like, you can't advance technologically. You can't do anything that would remotely affect the environment because that's bad. And so I think that I would really like to find somebody who's got a good balance between the two. Like, where is human advancement meeting the pro environment, and where is the harmony? because I feel like you get extremists on both sides, and it's really just kind of hard to find the middle ground. And I think that the middle ground is probably just kind of not really concrete and hard to come up with.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was listening to a radio show the other day. It was an interview, and I wish I could remember of whom. I think it was the Life Scientific, which is a BBC radio program. But this guy said something that's really stuck in my head. He said, "I am so tired of coming up with economic reasons for conservation." You know, and I thought of that, and I said, you know, I can understand that. I can see what he's saying. It's like, you know, so people are in extremes all everywhere. It's like requiring an economic reason for you to save like a species of monkey is also bad. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's just like, but yet they go too far. You know, I've worked for companies in the past that have had to deal with ridiculous things environmentally. Things that make absolutely no sense whatsoever and is helping no one, you know. So I have experience with that too. And yet those same laws could be good in another situation. You know what I mean?
I think the interesting thing about this book, though, is that he's describing a place that he knows is going to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And he might be the last person to see it.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, it's kind of like an epitaph, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and no matter if you think you should build dams and rivers or not, it's a place that is no longer there. So, you know, it was kind of nice to be able to read it.
Yeah.
When you read this book, when you were done with it, did you feel sad or did you feel
lazy? Yeah. I felt lazy. Haven't gone hiking in the desert, you know. I'm unlikely to take a hike that takes me too far off the paved road, and you know, I'm not going to cart in my water and drink mud from streams and
yeah.
Some of what he describes in the book, I don't think you would do these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, the amount of, I guess, discomfort he was willing to put up with to have the experiences that he had. I'm not that person. I'm glad he's that person.
It's great to read about.
Oh, yeah. Listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.